What we're talking about here is how do you make people really, really intrinsically want to follow you? Well, it takes influence capital. The leader has to have influence capital, and the amount of influence capital the leader has to make sure it has to measure up to the price tag of change. Every change, every transformation ultimately has a price tag associated with it. Every one of them. Gary, do me a favor. Go ahead and stand up on your feet there real quick. He said, oh no, not 8 o'clock on a Tuesday, Thursday. Okay. We just had a small transaction, Gary and I did. I simply asked him to stand up on his feet. That was a relatively small priced change. Right, according to our culture, that's not an unusual request, even from someone you've never met. Okay. Now, Gary, if I were to ask you to go ahead and take off your shirt and walk around this room squawking like a chicken, how would you feel about that request? Probably sit back down, in which you can. Thank you for the help, Gary. Thank you. And thank you for not taking off your shirt and squawking like a chicken. There's always a little bit of risk with that particular shtick because one of these days I'm going to run into somebody who, frankly, will do that, and it won't be that big a deal. So which of the two were obviously the higher price change? There's a big price tag associated with taking off your shirt and squawking like a chicken. Right, big price tag associated with that change versus standing on your feet. So there's one of two ways to look at, first, a successful transaction, and second, a failed transaction. We could either say that the second transaction failed because the price tag was too high, or we could say it differently, I don't have enough influence capital. There might be a person out there that Gary knows well, that Gary's in relationship with, that could ask Gary to do that and he would do it in a certain context. Okay, the price tag didn't necessarily change. It's just that this person that is asking him to do it has a tremendous amount of influence. So bottom line, what you're constantly trying to do as a leader, as a parent, as a business owner, as a minister, one of these days, your job is to always make sure that you always keep in mind that whatever price that is paid for the change I'm asking for has to not exceed the amount of influence capital that I bring to the relationship. My influence capital must always be greater than the price tag of the change I'm calling for. Does that make sense? Everybody follow? So this is really the essence of what it is to transform someone. So then the question is, where does the influence capital come from? Well, there's two basic paradigms in leadership literature that we could discuss. The first leadership power paradigm really is focused in the arena of the leader. We would normally say between the leader and the follower, if the leader and the follower are in a relationship with one another, the leader has all the power. If I were to present that presumption, none of you would argue with that. That's kind of assumed in our culture. The leader is where the power is at. And this really represents what I call a positional understanding of power. That power is a function of position. That because I have been asked by Instructor Long to stand before you, she has transferred my power to you, and you basically know that whoever she asked to stand up here in front of you, you get to listen to. It's a positional understanding of influence. There's another way, though, to look at power. And it's the one I really want to open your eyes to. And that is that ultimately, real power, the kind of power that can transform, the kind of power that can truly influence for the long term in tremendous ways, is ultimately not about my position. Ultimately, it is about your perception. It's your perception of me that ultimately matters most, not my position. What I mean is that the real power, the most important power when it comes to transforming people, does not lie with the leader, it lies with the follower. That is, your perception of me trumps my position over you. My position matters very little compared to your perception of me. Now, certainly, there is a time and a place for position to matter. Okay, you will always submit to positional authority, especially if you're reading Romans chapter 13, right? Jesus, Paul, says, submit to the authorities. That is a command. There is a time and a place to submit to the authority because it's about a position. What I'm addressing that isn't so much to discount that type of power and that type of influence. What I'm trying to say is that if you really want to be effective, don't get to the point where you rely on your position. What you want instead is you want the people's perception of you in that position ultimately to carry the day. It's a difference between pleading for the ordinary versus inspiring the extraordinary. Any one of you that have ever been inspired to do extraordinary things, I bet you that it was because of the person's influence over you, your perception of them that ultimately carried the day, not their position over you. There's a lot of people who've had positional authority over you that didn't get you to do anything substantial for long periods of time. So with that in mind, what I want us to do before I share my model, I want to share with you a movie clip that I think sums up quite nicely. No one was in this class last year. We're not boring anybody. Because I think we played this before, didn't we? I want to show you a movie clip right now. See if I can make this work. I want to share with you a movie clip, and some of you saw me queuing it up, Dead Poets Society. How many of you recall seeing Dead Poets Society? Hands? See, the generations are getting younger and younger, and that movie is getting older and older. Fewer and fewer people have seen Dead Poets Society. Worth going and renting. Worth purchasing on your Comcast cable, I suppose. What I want you to do, I want you to know a little bit about the background. This is the last scene in the movie. Mr. Keating is an English instructor at an all-boys preparatory high school, circa 1955. Mr. Keating has been at this school for about 6 months. It's about one semester. He's in the middle of the winter. He's been there for about a semester. He's had a tremendous amount of influence over these young men that he has been asked to teach. But he's extremely unorthodox in his approach. How many of you can recall some of the things that Mr. Keating did in his very first day on the job, his first day in the classroom, that really surprised some of these young men? Who can remember? Remember what one of his favorite places to teach from? You know, he would stand up on the desk and he would teach from up here because it gave him a different perspective on reality, right? Do you remember that his favorite poet was Walt Whitman? He had a picture of him over the blackboard, and he basically said, oftentimes standing from his desk, he said, "You can either call me Mr. Keating or what?" Do you remember what else he said you could call him? It was a term of respect. Brian's got it close. "Captain, my captain." Quoting the Walt Whitman poem. He was such a Walt Whitman fan. So he's very unorthodox. Remember what he did when he took them outside the classroom the very first day and he had them stare at all of the guys that were now worm food? All the guys that had gone before. These pictures of them taken when they were in their prime, 17 and 18 years of age, in the trophy case. Remember what he whispered in their ear? It was kind of the theme of the whole movie. Carpe diem. Carpe diem. Seize the day, gentlemen. Right? Be people of influence. Be people that matter. He also was going to teach them poetry. That was the topic of the class. And while he started by asking them to read the introduction to the textbook that basically measured the effectiveness of a poem on the Y and the X axis, he didn't have a whole lot of good things to say about the measurement of poetry. Remember what he had them do with the introductory chapter of the poetry textbook? Rip it out, right? And he walked around with the wastebasket and he had them all throw the introductory chapter in the wastebasket because he wanted to say, poetry is to be experienced, not measured, because it's supposed to fill you. You're supposed to suck deeply from the marrow of life. That's how Mr. Keating was. He was rather eccentric, but he inspired some of these young men to start the club on which the name of the movie is titled, and that is the Dead Poets Society. And it was a club that Mr. Keating, when he was a student at Welton years before, had started and they just restarted it. And these young men sneak out of their dormitory in the middle of the night to read poetry by candlelight in a cave. Right? This was exciting to them. It was somewhat rebellious. It was a place for them to really be inspired and to go do great things. Well, one young man in particular, Neil, was so inspired by his time of reading poetry and really understanding that there's more to life than he had ever been taught to believe. He decided to do something that he never thought, always wanted to do, but never had permission to do when he was living at home. He wanted to be an actor. His mom and dad said, "You will be a doctor. And you will have straight A's, and you will go to Harvard, and you will be a doctor." But all along, he wanted to be a thespian. He wanted to be an actor. And so what does he do because of this inspiring time reading poetry and being influenced by Mr. Keating? He goes and he tries out for the local community play to be Puck in the Midsummer Night's Dream. And he gets the part. The only problem with this is, in order to get permission as a minor to try out for the part, he had to forge his father's signature. The night before the play opens, his dad finds out what he had done, insists that he's going to become a doctor, refuses to let him become an actor, and he basically orders him to quit the play. Well, of course, Neil is in a bind because he's about to leave all of his troupe, his acting troupe, all of his colleagues high and dry the night before the big opening. And then Dad proceeds to go and get on an airplane to go to one of his many business trips. So what does Neil figure? Well, I'm not going to let these people down. I'm going to go through with it. We'll be done long before he gets back, and maybe he never even finds out. In either case, I don't care what the consequences are. I'm not going to let my friends down. So he goes ahead and goes through with it anyway, despite his father's expectations. Well, Dad apparently finds out sometime on the business trip what Neil is doing. Maybe it was the standing ovation that he got the night before, and then the standing ovation that he got the night before. And so he sneaks in on the third night, the closing night. He walks in the back. He came back early from his business trip. Is he thrilled? Is his heart softened because people are receiving his son and there's a standing ovation? He's doing such a fabulous job. No, not so much. He's livid. Because this is an outright form of rebellion. So he basically, literally, yanks him home by the ear and says, "You will quit Welton tomorrow. You're going to go to a new school. You will be a doctor. You got to get rid of all this acting garbage." And then the unthinkable happens in the movie. Neil decides that he can't live without hope. And he doesn't want to be a doctor, and he was experiencing more life watching that audience stand and applaud him than he had at any point in time thinking about being a doctor. And so he does the unthinkable. He takes his life. Definite low point of the movie. He commits suicide. Well, Welton, the school, has a reputation to keep. And when your star valedictorian senior class president commits suicide, you better find a scapegoat, and you better find one quick. And so all the young men who are friends of Neil are herded into Mr. Nolan's office, the principal, and are basically forced to sign a letter saying that Mr. Keating, the poetry teacher, is the one that is ultimately responsible for filling Neil's head with all this garbage. And so Mr. Keating loses his job over this. He's the fall guy. The scene you're about to see is the last scene in the movie. Lots of drama, lots of irony in this scene because Mr. Keating is returning to his classroom for the very last time, having just lost his job. He's having to return to his classroom because adjacent to this classroom is a small office in which a lot of his personal items are located, and he needs to retrieve them to go home. The interesting thing is that the principal, who just fired him, who forced all this bogus letter writing, is now filling in for Mr. Keating as the English instructor until a more appropriate English instructor can be found. Well, it's a good thing because Mr. Nolan is a former poetry teacher. So Mr. Nolan is just going to start reteaching poetry. I want you to watch the scene, and I want you to watch two types of leadership at work. Power by position, and power by perception. They're both very much at work in this scene. See if you can't pick out the difference between the two. There we go. What on earth does he have to be thankful for? He just lost his job. Respect. Obviously, he's got the respect of these young men, doesn't he? Who has more power in this scene? Mr. Nolan or Mr. Keating? But both forms of power are in play. We know Mr. Keating's power, and we would say that it's more powerful. Why? Because it takes a lot of guts. Talk about transformation. You know someone's transformed if they will stand up and defy the principal who's threatening them with expulsion in order to say, I respect you. So we know that there's more transformation that has taken place in the hearts of those young men who are standing. But we also see evidence that Mr. Nolan's power is at work in the hearts of some. How do you know who's subscribing more to Mr. Nolan's positional authority? How do you know who they are? They're sitting. But how are they sitting? With their heads down. They are cowering. I think that's probably the better way to describe what's happening with them. They're cowering. So let me ask you something. If you take all the young men that are cowering at their desks, and you put them in a classroom with Mr. Nolan for the rest of the semester, and you put all the young men that are standing on their desks for the rest of the semester with Mr. Keating, where do you think the most learning is going to go on? Most transformation? The most influence? Is it even going to be close? The point is this. People may submit to your positional authority for the short run, but you are inevitably causing them to respond with the most minimal standards imaginable. You're not asking them to achieve what is possible. You're only asking them to do the bare minimums. So if Mr. Nolan walks out of that classroom and he says, a lot of those young men really respect me more than Mr. Keating, that would not be an untrue statement. The problem is, what is the net effect of his influence in their life? I can get young men to sit at their desks and cower. Ooh. I'm impressed. What do you want to have your followers say about you for the rest of your life? Which would you rather have your children say about you? Wanting to do transformed living, standing on their desks metaphorically for the rest of their lives? Absolutely. That's what I want my sons to be. I want my sons to have such inherent respect because of their perception of me that ultimately trumps my position over them as their parent. Now, are there times when I have to, because I said so? Yes, you're about to cross the street, you're 6 years of age, you don't know better, because I said so, get over here now. But if that is the type of leadership that I keep falling back on, if I keep subscribing to because I said so, I'll slowly but surely train those that I lead to do the bare minimums. In the workplace, they'll come to work. They'll clock in. They'll go through the motions. In a church, they'll show up. About 3 out of 4 Sundays a year, if you're really, really good at it. Is anything going on in their heart? Is there really any transformation? If we want to be able to transform people, if we want to be people of influence, we have to understand that ultimately what matters more is follower perception, not a leader's position. So with that being stated, let me share with you now my model for leadership that is totally built and driven by the assumption that I've already shared. That is that a follower's perceptions trump a leader's position. So this whole model of leadership was developed over the last 10 years. It was the basis of my PhD work, where I asked the question, what perceptions do committed followers have of really effective leaders? And thus was able to build the following model. The basis of the model is transformation or growth, moving people from point A to point B. All leadership involves change. Where there is no change, there is no leadership. Think about the word T to lead. To lead implies movement. It implies change. It implies that we may have started at point A, but we end up at point B. And since I'm not talking about minimal changes, I'm interested this morning in the maximum changes, true transformation. I really think that kind of transformation happens incrementally over time. You can't transform somebody in a single 5-minute conversation. It is obvious right now to me, for some of you, non-verbally, I'm not connecting with you. I can tell that, and I'm totally okay with that. Because you know what? In an hour's time, I know that I don't have enough time to really build enough influence capital in your eyes for you to really engage with me. That's why I love teaching at the college level, because I had 16 weeks. 16 weeks to memorize everybody's name, 16 weeks to care about them, 16 weeks to invest in their lives. Over 16 weeks, you can actually build up enough influence capital where you can ask somebody to do something pretty spectacular. That's what we're talking about, is the incremental changes that happen more over time, not in a single moment like an hour-long class, okay? So how do you get somebody to grow from point A to point B? The first thing you have to do to be an effective leader, you have to be relational. Relational leadership. It's when you draw this, and if you're going to fill out the notes, make sure you do it spatially correct, because this is a spatially sensitive model. Relational leadership really has everything to do with point A, because this is where you meet people where they are. You relationally meet your followers where they are. That's the first step to being an exceptional leader. You care for them and you connect with them. You have a heart, represented by the heart. You have a heart for where your people are, where they start from. Relational leaders have a heart for people and are always willing to reach their followers where they are. That's the definition. Second, personal leadership. The second component, there's just four of them in the model. The second component is personal leadership. Personal leadership is defined as leading yourselves personally. Effective leaders must lead themselves personally, becoming the embodiment of organizational values. So since I'm talking about leading yourself personally, who do you think represents the running person up there at the top? That's you. That's the leader. In our circumstances right now, that's me. I represent the running person. My ability to lead myself personally is ultimately a function of your willingness to follow me. If I can't lead myself, you won't follow me. I like to say it this way. No one will ever follow you farther than you have led yourself. No one will ever follow you farther than you have led yourself. I am absolutely convinced that the problems that we're having in most of our churches is not that the followers aren't following. It's that they are. That's my message to church leaders. I do a lot of church consulting. And the subtitle of the book that I'm slowly tinkering on is Church Leaders, They Are the Way They Are, not because they don't follow, but because they do. When I say that, what am I saying? What's the first step to transforming the church? Okay, you got to meet them where they are, and then what's the second step? Once I've met you where you are and understand where my followers are at, now what do I have to do? Where do I have to focus my change energies? Who do I have to change first? Me. If you don't like how your organization or your followers, your family, fill in the blank. If you don't like how they're performing and you're the leader, I got news for you. Go take a long, long look in the mirror. Because chances are, they are the way they are, not because they don't follow, but because they do. So the first place to expend a lot of energy and effort anytime you want to become a person of influence is on yourself. You will never lead anyone farther than you are able to lead yourself. Both of these two factors of my model, I combine into a single factor that I call leadership eligibility, defined as follows. Eligibility to lead is having earned the right to lead extraordinary change. Having earned the right to lead extraordinary change. If I am a relational leader and I'm a personal leader, I have earned the right to lead change. The other half of the model is called capability. It's one thing to have the right to lead change. It's another thing to be able to. Some leaders have earned the right to lead change but have absolutely no clue where we're headed or how to get there. That's leadership capability. So to be an effective leader, you must be both eligible to lead change and capable of leading change. Let's see what capability is about. Capability has two factors as well. It starts with personal leadership, represented by an I, because it has to do with vision. And it is at the point B end of the spectrum. You have to have a vision for where you want people to go. You have to be leading on purpose. Too many leaders don't lead on purpose. They're not sure what success looks like. They're not sure what they want people to end up being like. So purposeful leadership is our leaders. Purposeful leaders lead toward a specific vision of the future. It's point B. It's one thing to know where we're headed, purposeful, but it's quite another thing to be able to know how to get there. And that's what directional leadership is about. The final element of my model, directional leaders have the skills for motivating incremental change, that is change a little bit every day, in the direction of the future vision. So imagine that purposeful leadership is really knowing where we're headed. Directional leadership is knowing how to get there. So if you want to really sum up my model into four words, relational leadership is being about you. Personal leadership is me. Purposeful leadership is where we're headed. Directional leadership is how we're going to get there. You, me, where, how. That's leadership. You, me, relational, personal, purposeful, where, directional, how. You, me, where, how. If you don't have all four of those, you're not a great leader. How many of you ever known a great leader that was eligible? They were all about the you and all about the me, but had no clue where. No vision. And what do we read in Proverbs? Without vision, what? The people perish, Scripture says. Without vision, the people will perish. So you have to have a strong vision. I want to take a few minutes to reinforce that point right now. Come on over here, everybody up. I'm going to have to wake you up for a few minutes. Come over here and grab a piece of the puzzle. The puzzle is upside down. Kind of get all the way around this table. We're going to put this puzzle together right here. Okay? So just grab one, but don't turn it over. I don't want you to see the colors. I just want you to see the white. Everybody take a spot. There should be enough for everyone to have at least one, and maybe one or two of you end up with two. I think there's 20 pieces there. Everybody get over here and grab a piece of the puzzle. Now, here are your instructions for putting this together. I want you to see how fast you can put it together. We're going to do this at least a couple times, and you're going to time yourself. But here's the trick. This first time, you can't turn the puzzle pieces over. You can't see what the color is. You have absolutely no idea what the end product's supposed to look like because all you see is the white. And worst of all, no verbal communication. Don't talk to one another. I don't mind some nonverbal communication. That's probably what it's going to take to finish this project. But no verbal communication, and let's see how quickly we can get this done. Ready? We're going to start in 4 seconds. Everybody got a piece? Everybody grab a piece. Everyone needs a piece. Everybody grab a piece. When everybody has a piece, then we'll go. All right? Go ahead and grab two if they're not all taken. Everybody have one? Everybody have one. Grab two. Victor's got two. Good. All right. Ready, set, go. See how quickly we can do this. Okay, been at it 1 minute. Lindsay, your piece is already at work over there. It's done. Close. We're getting close. 1:45. Done. 5:05. Okay, second time through, we're going to do it a little bit differently. I'm sorry. That's right, 205. Notice the great instructors are there. They're going to make sure that we don't get a grade any better than you deserve. All right, go ahead and let's flip it over. We can see the color now. I want you all to distribute it. You need one or two. I'm also going to show you up here what you're aiming at. Let me show you. Here it is. That's the picture. So go ahead and take a few minutes to kind of analyze the pieces and analyze the picture. And y'all can, if you want to keep staring at that to help you. The other difference is that you can go ahead and communicate now. Okay, you can go ahead and talk to one another. But everyone grab a piece. Make sure that there's no pieces down there. We're going to get going here in 15 seconds. And we're going to see how much better we can do than 2:05 by communicating and by seeing what it is that we're aiming at. Okay? Go ahead and take a few seconds to strategize if you want. The key is to see how quickly we can do this. If you're smart, you're going to make sure that everyone's around this table already kind of in the close proximity of where their puzzle piece is going to be used. We're going to start in 20 seconds. Okay, let's see if we can do this in less than 30 seconds. We're starting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Forty-one seconds. Go ahead and be seated. Good job. Good job. Well done. All right. So while we're sitting down, what are some of the obvious lessons, the difference between those two experiences as it relates to leadership, as it relates to vision? What are some lessons? Why did we do 3 times better the second time than the first time? Okay, so leadership is important. Okay. You knew absolutely what you were aiming at. What else? You can communicate. And really, leadership and communication go hand in hand. If you can't communicate, you can't lead. Which is interesting. What that means then is if you're a leader that's not communicating, then you're not a leader. Leadership is about communication. Okay, and so whenever I told you you couldn't communicate, there wasn't a leader, really. Okay, so it wasn't until we said we can communicate that we had a leader. So we had good communication, we had leader, they go hand in hand. We knew what we were aiming at. What else made a difference? Go ahead, Lindsay. Huh? Okay, so we knew what we were aiming at. What else were you able to see the second time that you didn't the first? That's right, Gene. I mean, if you don't know the part you play, then you're not going to be very effective or efficient. All right, you just kind of stand there until someone says, here, give me the piece of your puzzle. But if you know what we're aiming at, you know the part that you have to play, and you can communicate, now you can get things done, both more efficiently and more effectively. That's leadership. That's really all that we're talking about here with my model. Purposeful is where we're headed. Directional is the part that every person has to play in order to accomplish the vision organizationally. Now, the bottom five words at the bottom of this slide are important to me because these are what I consider the five levels of leadership. I have developed an instrument for measuring this model. So I go into organizations and I say to those that are following, tell me how your leader is doing. How do you perceive your leader? So you've got to be a pretty courageous leader in order to invite me into your organization. It would be the same thing, Daniel, as me showing up in here and saying, all right, guys, we want to know how is Instructor Long doing in here? Rate Instructor Long on 56 factors of inspiring leadership. Daniel would enjoy that. I did see a little bit of rise at him. He was enjoying the thought of doing that very exercise. Once you've answered 56 questions rating your leader, you notice it's a little bit backwards. Usually in most organizations, it's the leader who's rating the followers. In my case, it's the other way around. Then the leader is given one of five categories of leadership from each individual follower. And each follower is going to view each leader a little bit differently. Each of you right now view me either as transforming, that is someone who, you know what, I wouldn't mind following this guy. If he were to teach a class here, I think I'd like to hear him 16 weeks straight. Hey. Some of you are ready to go transforming. Others of you aren't so convinced yet. It's more of a maintaining relationship. I'm not necessarily the kind of person that you would follow off a cliff, but you know what? You're not frustrated by me and you're not distressed and I don't neutralize you. It's a maintaining relationship. It's a good experience. It's just not over the top. A neutralizing perception is one where you're still ambivalent. You know, you're not exactly sure. More ambiguity. I'm not sure. That's really the essence of neutralizing. Some of you may even prove frustrated by certain people that you have to follow. You're frustrated by their leadership. Okay, that's a disagree that they're a good leader. Strongly disagree. That's distressing leadership. And some of you have had the experience of having to follow someone that was a distressing leader to you. You strongly disagree that they were effective, that they had any influence. So the question I want you to keep in mind as I finish in these last 15 minutes or so talking about some of the concepts, ask yourself, those that you are asked to lead, how would they view you? If I were to show up in your organization and I were to say, here, fill out this questionnaire, 56 issues related to leadership, how would you do? How would you do with each and every individual? Because every individual is going to view you slightly differently. So let's talk about vision a little bit more. We obviously have done the puzzle exercise. Talk a little bit more. One of the ways that we've got to communicate as effective leaders is to communicate the vision over and over and over. A lot of leaders have a vision, they just don't talk about it often enough. And so by having the picture up here on the screen, we were in effect allowing the vision to be communicated often. It was up there permanently for everyone to see. Effective leaders not only communicate the vision often, but they do it in a compelling way, in a very vivid way, a very specific way. Okay? I like to say it this way, that there's really only one reason that anybody changes. Lindsay, what is it? What is the only reason that anybody changes? There's really only one if you boil it all down. Anything come to mind? Really only one. Okay. Which even that is ultimately based on one reason. Why do they want to follow everyone else? Well, they just want to. They want to. To make it real simple, the only reason anybody does anything is because they want to. They're motivated to do it. And Lindsay's exactly right. In some cases, we are motivated to want to do what everyone else is wanting to do. But bottom line, it's because they want to. Your job is to describe the vision in such a way that the pain of the unrealized future is greater than the pain of change. All change is painful, yes? Anybody just love change? Can't wait to change today. Now, no one likes to change. So your job in the game of change management as a transforming leader is to describe the future in such palatable ways, in such compelling ways. Describe it so that people are aching more in their status quo because they don't have what you're describing. And so until you describe the pain of the unrealized future in such vivid ways that they would rather endure the pain of change, they never will. I've got to describe to you the importance of being a great leader in such vivid ways that you're willing to change your behavior. Now, none of us naturally like change. So that means that's a pretty tall order. As a leader, you have to describe the vision in compelling ways. Whether it be a coach, whether it be a minister, whether you be a parent, you've got to describe the vision clearly, often, and in a compelling way. How about directional? Let's talk about directional just for a few minutes. What does it mean to be a great directional leader? You have to be a competent decision maker. You have to know what you're doing. Some of these guys didn't. How many of you have ever seen this running across the web yet? This poor fella is not a competent decision maker. He's not a systems thinker. He's not thinking about the consequences of his behavior. And if you can't see over here, this is a welder. So he's welding, and this is a rather primitive way to jack your truck up, right? Not a very competent. No one would want to follow this guy underneath that truck. Yeah, teach me how to weld, please. Okay? Let me show you another one. That guy probably lost his job. That is a warhead that fell off of the loading dock. So certainly evidence of more incompetence. But this one may be the best one of all. That is a power tool. It is a power drill plugged in. We see the power cord. Bare feet, aluminum ladder in a pool. Yes. But the important thing is to note that he does have his safety goggles on. And so he's not perfectly incompetent. He is concerned about safety. Right. None of these are folks that you would want to follow because they don't make good decisions. They don't see the consequences of their immediate decisions and the impact they have on the whole. Great decision making is ultimately about systems thinking. Can you see both the big picture and the small picture and how the two relate? That's one aspect of competence. The second is confidence in people's ability to produce. Confidence in people's ability to produce. People will live up to or down to the expectations that you have of them. It's what we call self-fulfilling prophecy. If I tell you that you have the ability to be an exceptional leader, and I tell you over and over and over because I honestly believe it, you will live up to that expectation. On the other hand, if I tell you, Johnny, you don't have any business speaking out over there, you're pathetic. And I tell you that over and over and over, you will live down to that expectation. This was proven by a bunch of teachers who were asked to participate in a laboratory assignment. The teachers were told at the beginning of the year, we're going to do something unique with this one school to see if it doesn't improve test scores. We're going to take all of the less than stellar students, the slower students, and we're going to put them in a room together. And we're going to put them together so that the teacher knows, okay, everybody in my classroom is slow. I need to go slower. I need to instruct harder. But we're going to put them together. And all of the really bright students, we're going to put them in a classroom so that the teacher knows that you got all the bright ones. Well, at the end of 6 weeks, they had to stop the laboratory experiment because of what they were seeing in the test scores. They couldn't ethically continue. It would have been unfair to the students to continue. See, really, they lied from day one to the teachers. the students weren't brighter in one classroom and more dumb in the other. They were randomly selected. But they didn't tell the teacher that. And the effect that it had on the teacher, what kind of effect do you think it had on the teacher? If one of the students in the dumb class was struggling, what do you think the teacher would be tempted to do? Oh, bless your heart. I know this is hard for you. It's okay. If you don't get it, Brian, we understand. We understand. Based upon where you went to high school and some of your test scores, it's going to be okay. It's, you know, D-plus works okay. You know, and then Matt, in my smart class, you know what? If you're not getting it, but I know you're in the bright class, then generally as a teacher, what am I likely to do? No, you can do this. I know you can. You're brilliant. Right? What are they thinking? You wouldn't be in this class if you weren't brilliant. And so the smart kids are constantly being told by the teachers, who don't know any different, this person's bright. There was an 18-point difference between test scores after 6 weeks. The only variable was the expectations of the teacher and the fact that they were communicated to the students. The message is this: if you want people to accomplish great things, you have to believe that they can. And if you don't believe they can, then you don't have any business trying to inspire them to do great things. People will live up to or down to the expectations that we have of them. Some of you are still operating out of self-fulfilling prophecies you've inherited from your children, from your parents, or from your teachers. You were either told you're really, really bright and you can do it, or you were told the opposite. And you need to get out of that stinking thinking, for those of you that are told you can't. You need to surround yourself with leaders who believe you can. That's the essence of directional leadership. Don't have the time to go any more deeper than that. We're going to fly through this. Ooh, looky there. Relational leaders. Let's talk about relational and personal. We'll be done. Relational leaders, remember, have a heart for people. They're willing to reach followers where they are. Bruce, go ahead and click that so they might be able to see this a little better. This is a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. Calvin says, I like people. I'm interested in people. Hobbes is surprised by this. You? As an audience, I mean. Oh. How many of you know people who are only interested in others as an audience? All of us? The truth is, part of what it means to be fallen and sinful is that we really like being the center of attention. It is really, really hard to be genuinely interested in others as anything but an audience. We generally like others to be genuinely interested in us. The first step to being an exceptional leader is learning to be genuinely interested in others. If you haven't learned the art of empathy, if you haven't learned to be genuinely interested in others, you will never be an exceptional leader. It's what we call emotional intelligence. And that is honestly why we as Christian people, following the most empathetic, the most genuinely interested human being to ever walk the planet, as followers of Jesus Christ, we ought to be the greatest leaders that the world has ever known. Because we are more genuinely interested in others than anyone else. Why? Because we follow Jesus. Got to be genuinely interested in others if you want to be effective. Show concern and success for others more than your own. Initiate meetings with top performers. That's number two. Initiate meetings with top performers. What I want to say on this is, as a leader, don't get in the trap of waiting for those that you lead to come to you. How many of you have ever heard the business term open door policy? You heard this term before? Okay. Jacqueline, what does that mean? Great. And that's a good thing, right? It's a good thing to have an open door policy. Yes? Yes? The problem is, open door policy is not the best thing. It's better than a closed door policy, but there's something better than open door policy. And it's what later business scholars come to term management by walking around. Management by walking around. In other words, I have a choice. I can sit in my office with my door open and say, come see me if you need me, but you've got to initiate. Johnny, if you want to come see me, my door's open. I've got office hours. You know when to come see me. That is one level of empathy. It's quite another thing for me to go out of my way to say, Johnny, I'd love to get together. Let's go get a Coke and let's just talk about how you're doing. One, the second, communicates far more interest in you than the other. Because one says, Johnny, you're responsible for coming and seeing me because I'm the important one, I'm the busy one, I've got the tight schedule, come see me, I'll make time for you, but you've got to come to me. The other says, Johnny, you're so important to me, I am going to arrange my schedule around yours. How would you like to get together? The second makes a lot more psychological impact in a positive way. The point is this, don't wait for your followers to come to you. Go to your followers. Initiate with them. Initiate with them. And when you get there, be a great listener. Be a great listener. Great leaders are great listeners more than they're great speakers. I spend far too much of my leadership career talking and far too little listening. Here's why listening is so important. The more I listen to you, the smarter I become. Okay, because I understand where you're coming from. I understand your point of view. And the interesting thing is, the smarter you see me. Here's the way this works. We all inherently assume that we're bright people. We just automatically assume that we've got a corner on truth, that the world revolves around us. It's part of our fallen nature. We think that our perspective is the only perspective. So if we sit down with somebody, a leader in particular, who takes the time to really, really listen and understand our point of view, we immediately are thinking the following. Wow, I'm brilliant. This guy obviously understands I'm brilliant because he's listening. So anybody who's brilliant enough to understand my brilliance is worth listening to as well. I get smarter in your eyes the more I listen to you. So become a great listener. Your IQ will go up. What I call your LQ, your listening quotient, ultimately has everything to do with your perceived IQ, your intelligence quotient. So if you're afraid of saying the wrong thing the next time you're sharing your faith with someone, let me give you a hint. Quit trying so hard to share your faith. Spend all your time listening to their story rather than telling your own, and you'll be amazed how brilliant you become in their eyes. That's the best step for evangelism, is to shut your mouth and listen. Last night I was in a Bible study with a young woman who'd never been in one of our cell groups. And we were busy, the cell leader up until a certain point was busy trying to tell her about us. And finally we thought better of that, and we spent the last half listening to her. And it's amazing how much better she felt after we spent all of our time listening to her, showing genuine interest. Listening to her. Does that make sense? The final point is personal leadership. I want to say just a few things about this. This is walking the talk. This is walking the talk. Seeking constructive criticism. The cool thing about being a great personal leader is that you need to be consistent. You need to practice what you preach, but you don't need to be perfect. What research tells us is that people are more inspired by imperfect people who admit that they're imperfect. Isn't that good news? You don't have to be perfect. In fact, people would prefer that you not be. They want you to be consistent, but then they want you to be candid enough to admit your imperfections. That's the essence of great leadership. So you got to seek constructive criticism. It's better to under-promise and over-deliver. Don't make commitments that you can't follow through on. And then finally, be responsible in controlling your emotions. Understand that you are in control of yourself. You have to lead yourself if you want anyone to follow you. You got to be a lifelong learner, too. You've got to constantly be learning. And that's why I applaud you guys for being here. I know it's tough to be here at 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning learning, but I applaud you in doing so. I want to conclude in these last 2 minutes with a story that will hopefully, if you don't remember much anything else I said today, remember this story. About a man named Dan Harrell. When I was at ACU as a student and as a campus minister, when I wasn't working on my master's, I was a campus minister at a church there in Abilene, Texas. So I'm the campus minister working with college students. Dan Harrell is an elder at this particular church, Southern Hills. Dan Harrell is a retired dentist. He made a lot of money early on in life. He retired at age 55. And so now he is simply living in Abilene, and he's basically eldering full-time, not taking any money from the church. Most of you have been in enough churches to know that an elder is basically the patron. They are the boss. And as the minister, I am the employee. So understand the relationship. Dan Harrell decides at age 55 he's going to go get more education. He ends up in a class, a one-week short course on the book of Revelation. Okay, master's course, it goes from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. By the time you're done on Friday, you're done with the class. I took 80 pages of single-spaced typed notes in this course by Dr. Ian Fair. He used to be the dean of the College of Bible at ACU. Brilliant man on Revelation. On Thursday evening, we all met up at the church building, all the students from the class, to pour over everyone's notes to be prepared for the final exam that was given on Friday afternoon. So a lot of studying, a lot of facts, remember, in a very short period of time. We studied from about 5 o'clock, the end of the class, till about 10:30 that night. Most everyone felt as comfortable as they could memorizing that much material for a class, a test the next day. The only problem was Dan Harrell, my elder, who's in this class with me at age 55, 56, isn't getting it very quickly. Everyone else starts saying, I'm going to go home and get some rest. I'll see y'all tomorrow for the test. Okay. But Dan still is struggling. He can't get the material. Well, Mama didn't raise no fool. I'm not about to leave my elder high and dry, unprepared for this exam. So I am there to the bitter end, right? Dan Harrell will make a good grade on this test if I have anything to say about it. Never mind the fact that I had the material down by about 10:30. I'm here for him. Along about 1:30 in the morning, it's just he and I sitting in this elder's conference room. He's feeling horrible. He says, I know you would be home by now asleep. Thank you for staying with me. I don't know why I can't get it. And I said, you know what, Dan? I just am inspired that you would want to come and get a master's this late in life. So anything to help you. Well, that's when he told me. He said, oh, I'm not getting a master's. You're not getting a master's? What are you doing in this class? You know, I'm auditing. You're auditing? Okay, so forget that he's an elder at this point, right? You're not getting a grade for this? You're not getting a grade for this. I'm here at 2 o'clock in the morning helping you with a final exam that you're not getting a grade for. You're auditing? What are we doing here, Dan? I could have been asleep 2.5 hours ago. And that's when I loved his answer. I said, why are you doing this? Why are you studying so hard for a test you don't even have to take? I'll never forget his answer. He said, well, I'm doing it because I think it'll make me a better elder. Dan Harrell, lifelong learner. I keep telling that story because he's an inspiration for me. He's an inspiration for me because about 6 months later, we found out why Dan Harrell wasn't getting the material. Early onset Alzheimer's was diagnosed. Dan is only about 65 right now, but he doesn't know anyone. I don't know how much longer he'll be alive. I tell you that story because I want you to take inspiration from Dan the same way I do. When you don't want to read another book, I want you to remember Dan Harrell. A man that at age 55 was going to study and learn as much as he could so he could be the best leader he could, even if he didn't have to. I read a lot of books these days, probably 40 or 50 books a year. I probably read more than I did when I was in graduate school. People often ask, why, Brent? I'm fond of saying, because Dan can't. I'm reading for Dan. I want you to be a great leader. Great leaders are listeners, but they're also learners. And that makes all of you this morning in here great potential leaders. I so appreciate your attention. Let me close this with prayer. Father God, we thank you for the time. I pray that some of the principles that were shared this morning will resonate, that they'll be remembered, and that more importantly, they'll be applied. Make a radical difference in the kingdom because of the leaders in this room. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.